Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I've said it here before, and it bears repeating, that when a police officer shoots and kills a civilian, almost no matter the circumstances, the question we should be asking is not one of whether it was justified, but whether it was preventable. Police officers nearly always say their shootings are justified, and to bolster that claim, they cite policy, training, and the law. It is lawful to shoot someone in self-defense or in defense of others, and this extends to cases where a person is fleeing and the officers feel the person poses an imminent threat to others, such as when the person is driving a vehicle and officers witness that driver endangering themselves or others with that vehicle. But being legal, as in permitted by law or sanctioned by legal precedent, is a very binary metric to apply to a situation characterized by nuance and ambiguity. Cincinnati motorist Samuel DeBose was shot and killed while driving away from an officer who claimed that simply putting the car in motion while the officer was leaning toward the driver's side window posed a life-endangering threat. Tamir Rice and John Crawford both had toy guns and were not actually threatening anyone, but officers claimed they shot because they perceived a public safety threat. Countless police shooting victims were doing nothing more than reaching for a wallet or a cell phone, like Amadou Diallo or Columbus's own Andre Hill. And now we have 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant, shot and killed while apparently threatening another individual with a knife during an argument. Police body cam footage, as well as security camera footage from nearby houses, do indeed show Micaiah pursuing two women and physically attacking them, before cornering one against a car and raising a kitchen knife as if to stab her. The first officer to respond, Nicholas Reardon, had just seconds to react, though just as he approached, Micaiah and one of the two she was arguing with tumbled to the ground at his feet before Micaiah rose to her feet and advanced toward the second individual. That's the moment at which Reardon fired four shots, killing Micaiah. Judging from those videos alone, and especially from the first video released within hours by the Columbus Police Department, it's easy to form an opinion that largely concurs with the officer's explanation that force was necessary to prevent Micaiah from harming the woman she was threatening. But this may be a lesson in the foolhardiness of jumping to conclusions. There's a lot that the videos don't show, and broader questions that transcend the details in that instance. Who were the two that Micaiah was arguing with? What were their actions prior to the altercation? Could the conflict have been de-escalated or resolved? Was Micaiah acting in self-defense, or did she have reason to believe she was? What roles did the other adults in the vicinity, what might have they have played in to affect a different outcome? And more broadly, why was Micaiah in a foster home, and what was the responsibility of the city agencies that administer foster case programs, knowing that numerous 911 calls had reportedly been replaced from or about that home in recent months? These questions may have a bearing, and there are specific details about the shooting. Did Micaiah drop the knife before being shot, as one witness claimed? Would Micaiah have actually stabbed the other person, or was she simply using the knife as a threat? We do note that another witness claimed to have heard Micaiah making a verbal threat announcing her intent to stab, but Officer Reardon has not stated that he heard that. Could a taser or physical restraint have been used seconds earlier when Micaiah and the second person fell to the ground in front of him? And lastly, might there be a nexus here of various competing narratives, each of which may have a degree of merit? Did Officer Reardon feel he had no other choice but to shoot? Was it necessary to shoot four times? Was that part of his training? And concurrently, might he have acted differently if Micaiah had been white? Suppose the altercation had taken place in Clintonville or Upper Arlington or another affluent or middle-class white suburb. Would a troubled foster facility have persisted in one of those neighborhoods? And would Micaiah have even been a ward of the state? Naturally, there have been protests in response. I attended one of those and recorded the speakers who you'll hear in today's program. And there are those who feel Micaiah was murdered outright and that racism is the underlying condition that led to her death, including on the part of Officer Reardon. But to listen, and I mean really listen, to the folks calling for justice in the case of Micaiah Bryant, they're taking a broader, more global view, taking the entire context into account. And in that view, it matters less whether Officer Reardon had cause to shoot, or even what his reasons or prejudices may have been. After all, holding Reardon or Derek Chauvin or Adam Coy or Sheriff's Deputy Jason Mee, the killer of Casey Goodson, accountable, only chips away at the problem without getting to the root. Activists want more than that. They're demanding systemic changes and radical overhauls to both policing and culture, not only within law enforcement, but within the city administration as well. I met with organizer Heather Johnson late last week.
Okay, so my name is Heather Johnson. I am a community advocate.
Tell us a little bit of background about, you know, the history of the movement here in Columbus, as so far as you've been able to observe, especially recently.
So I started with, remembering about Trayvon Martin, Freddie Grace, just a lot of names. And so in Columbus, it's taken another impact on us because a lot of us don't know that we are in the top 10 city of police killing our children. We're in the top 10 city of the police murdering civilians and always having like an officer involved incident. With that being said, it's not been highlighted. We just recently started getting traction, and I will start with Casey Goodson Jr. Within the past 6 months. And then that led to Andre Hill. There's one name that I'm forgetting, but then there's Miles Jackson, Micaiah Bryant. And all of them need to be uplifted. I don't understand why we are fighting, but I do understand that the system wasn't made for us. And when I say us, I'm talking Black people.
So there have been quite a few protests ever since the televised killing of George Floyd, since that video went viral. We had a whole month, maybe a month and a half, of continuous protests every day in Columbus, a couple of which at the very beginning resulted in some property damage, and unfortunately a portion of the population, armchair cynics, let's say, remember that and have long since forgotten the grievances that led to those demonstrations and made them necessary. Has it been a struggle both to articulate the demands of the movement, make that clear in people's minds, and to overcome those kinds of prejudicial obstacles?
Oh, yes. It's definitely a battle, especially when you are dealing with a system that doesn't believe in protecting Black people. Here in Columbus, as many strides as we have made, such as Mayor Coleman being the first Black mayor, Shannon Harden being the first openly gay city council president, and being able to be in the capacity to have inclusion and diversity, we've also slacked so much, and we failed our community. And our demands seem very simple. What we're asking for, and we stand in agreement with other organizers, are to make historical investments in Black people and communities, ensuring that Black kids have access to a high-quality education, for the needs to be addressed to the homeless crisis, and the need to remove police officers from dealing with quality of life issues such as homelessness, substance abuse, mental health crisis, sex work, and etc. These issues we're asking to be handled by trained counselors and professionals.
And of course, this came to a head after the a whole season of protests following George Floyd, and then there were several other killings prior to Casey Goodson and Andre Hill, which led to the city council sort of tepidly endorsing a civilian review board plan, although that had to be passed by the Columbus voters to get any actual kind of movement on that. The mayor established a commission to draft the proposal, following the legal mandate, and has now identified people to appoint to that review board, but it's held up because of conflicts with the police contract, I understand.
Definitely.
And in the meantime, though, what's the mood of the movement? Is everything just sort of on hold? Or I know there have been demonstrations recently within the last few weeks.
The movement is never on hold. We're always continuing to move in either a protest way, I know that you earlier asked me a question and I didn't hit on it, and it was about people's mindset and taste in their mouth for having demonstrations that look like riots. If your police officers are killing your children, killing people that you care about, upstanding citizens to the point where we can't bring Subway to our families, we can't talk to the police with a cell phone in our hand, we can't stand our grounds with a knife, we're unable to have access to medical care because police presence in hospitals, all of these are taking its toll. And I know people are tired of seeing people's streets being blocked. Well, we're tired of blocking it. And with no justice, it's no peace until you prosecute these police. And that's a big thing. The movement is important and it's continually moving. And the thing about it is that we don't get acknowledgement for our community gives. We do a lot in the community. There's a lot of us that work with houseless folks, such as me, and also making sure that people have access to getting somewhere safe. There's a lot of things that we do in our community because this is the support. This is who protects us, is our community.
So with the Derek Chauvin trial, a lot of people were concerned that if the verdict was an acquittal, that there'd be massive unrest across the country and the cycle would repeat of people speaking out in various ways, other people criticizing the people who are speaking out, and the issues that led to the need for people to speak out being kind of sidelined. And then, surprisingly to many, the verdict went the other way, and some people feel that justice was served. However, there are those who feel that the verdict itself was not justice, but merely an incremental step. Mm-hmm. What's your feeling about that, and what's the mood of the movement with regard to that issue now?
I follow with the organizers in Minnesota. This is just a first step. We appreciate that Derek Chauvin has been tried, but we wish that George Floyd would have had the same opportunity. What we're asking for are not just to prosecute the police, not just to retrain, but to have a new system on what public safety looks like. That's my take on it. I'm very grateful that we have guilty verdicts, but knowing that this man will still be able to call his kids, speak to his ex-wife, who I thought I want to make sure that we acknowledge, tried to divorce him in 5 days after he had killed George Floyd, and this was a strategic move presented by the FOP, because in the divorce, she would have been able to have Derek transfer all of the things that are in his name to her in the divorce. And there was a judge that stopped that. So they're still doing sneaky stuff, you know. It looked good to us, like, yeah, divorce that man, you know. But in actuality, it was the FOP and legal assistants that were like, hey, if you divorce him now, you can work it like this and still not be touched and still protect him with his assets, because he's still entitled to pension right now, and people don't even understand that his pension is still going to be paid,
but now it'll be paid to her if he's in jail for a long time. Of course, we don't know the sentencing. That's another step. Are people kind of anxious and waiting to see how that turns out?
Definitely, especially with the judge. I do believe that he was fair, but he was also I don't think that he understands the trauma that has been brought upon the whole world. This is not something that just affected Minnesota. This is somewhere where you can go to Nigeria and they're talking about this. You can go to Asia and they're talking about George Floyd. Everyone knows George Floyd's name and the reason why there's such civil unrest in the United States right now.
So with the sentencing coming up, although that's not going to happen for a couple of months yet,
correct.
There are other incidents around the country, and there are other drives, other pushes, other demands for reform. What's the status of those in Columbus now? We're waiting on negotiations of the police contract. The Civilian Review Board has not actually been seated yet. There have been a few policy changes proposed or implemented, such as body cameras and cases being referred to a statewide investigative board every time police do use force. Are those sufficient steps, or is the pace of progress too slow? What milestones need to be achieved in the very short term?
So the first thing, when I was listening to you asking me these questions, I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, we have people that's been in office for years. This has been going on for years. I'm an 80s baby. The first case I remember is Rodney King. Police brutality has been something that the only thing that I see that has changed is the quality of cameras. That's sad. We have a system that we're working with that works and controls the system. If I was in power, would I want to give up my power to listen to the community when, if we really think about it, the people who they truly want to listen to are the same people that wrote Who Could Vote, and that's white men that own land. So we're still fighting that. This process is happening way too slow for us. The Civilian Review Board, although I have big respect for Dr. Chanel Jones, I don't have respect that there's not near one organizer on that review board. I also don't understand how you can have the police themselves. And that is them being on our civilian board, being formal officers. You know, we're not getting the one who wrote A Thin Blue Line. We're not getting ex-officer McFadden. We're getting people who are living on their pension. They're not going to really want to affect that, and they're pro-police. If I work for a police and I served 35 years, I'm not going to go against the police now. What makes us think that the police investigating the police in every capacity, whether it's the Civilian Review Board or the Columbus Police Department saying, hey, we sent it to investigations, and they're investigating themselves. If my teacher would have allowed me in school to investigate myself, I would never be guilty either. That makes no sense. Would you be guilty if you had a choice to say, I'm going to investigate myself, but I think that I made quite a good decision?
Right. Well, the quality of those decisions is certainly at issue with regard to the latest shooting. We've seen the body cam videos of the shooting, and to be honest, they do look as though the officer acted within a split second. He saw the victim wielding a knife, apparently attempting to stab another person. So the officer's explanation that he shot in order to save another life seems to have some merit or some plausibility, but of course that's not the only variable. There's mm-hmm. a much larger story surrounding that. What should people know about that shooting, and can you kind of walk us through chronology of the details?
So I've been getting second and third hand information, and I think it's very important for me to say that. We need to also identify what has even gotten to us to see this as the product, right? That's what they say in math, product. So the product is that Micaiah Bryant can never go home. Your split decision to take her life and shoot her four times has caused for this child not to be able to go home. But the bigger issue is that this girl was actually in an altercation with these folks for 48 hours prior to her calling the police. She has dealt with harassment. This is the reason why I believe that we should have a call on ending child welfare. We have children that are in unsafe positions, and they are having to do something that is trying to save their life. And I think that that's how Micaiah acted. Micaiah was in self-defense. I don't understand how I'm in a place where it's staying your grounds, but only when your grounds is a gun and not a knife. I watched the tape, and with as many officers We need to be teaching and escalating and uplifting de-escalation tactics and conflict resolution. There were several adults watching this fight. I believe that every single one of them should be charged for her murder, including the officer. They did not keep her safe. They did not de-escalate the issue. And if anything, watching the video, watching that man kick someone out the way, it just escalated it even more. And I think that this child was in a fight for her life. And she also contacted multiple friends, which allowed me to get an account of the story. This girl stated that she wasn't going to allow her autistic foster sister to get the same treatment as she did. She could handle it. She knew that this autistic child couldn't. And she tried to save her life. So now where is this child who has autism going to get that safe person? Because that was what Makiyah Bryant was. She was a safe person to save our folks and to allow inclusivity. So that's one of my big things in the end child welfare, and to promote de-escalation and promote us to being able to resolve issues in a safe manner, and to teach the youth and allow them to have a place to express their hurt. Because these teenagers are hurt. And if you thought that a whole bunch of adults taking the street was bad, imagine what teenagers who don't have that moral compass yet will do.
So if you could be a little more specific, because I know listeners will be curious about the details. So what do you know about the conflict that Makiyah was involved in? It's been reported that the people that she was confronting on the day of her killing were assailants. They were identified as assailants, that they were not teenagers, that they were older than that, and that they had actually entered her home. And you saying that this conflict had progressed over the course of a couple of days. What can you tell us about the specific conflict?
So again, I'm going to make sure that I say that this is second and third hand information. From what I was advised, the timeline went like as such. The foster mother that Makiyah was placed under was having issues and disputes with Makiyah. At that time, she felt that it was better for her to allow her other foster children that she has fostered before to take over and to try to get her in some sort of submissive mode. When this was happening, this was constant torture. So we're talking about however long she was there. You know, she was being harassed like that because of how she kept herself. This is things that her friends has mentioned, that she had kept herself nice. She kind of minded her business, but she wasn't going to take anything from anybody. And being a foster child has made her have her flight and fight senses just higher than, you know, a normal person, because she's in an environment where this is not her mom and dad protecting her. She's actually a ward of the state. These people had intention to do harm. And from what the friends were told before she called the police, she made a call out for her friends. And per the live videos, they were trying to tell Makiyah to stay in the house. And once she didn't stay in the house, she decided to call the police, who is to protect and serve, and ended up being to her demise.
So do we know anything about how she ended up in a foster situation?
I did not ask that. Right now, it's such a trauma issue dealing with teenagers who have suffered this type of loss and grief. These teenagers just recently lost a girl at Westerville North. An African-American black girl took her life in front of her parents. And now we're dealing with the police taking our black girls' lives as well. So I don't ask those type of questions. I allow our relationship to foster. And then I don't have to ask those type of questions because they'll come to me.
Well, of course, it doesn't make a difference in terms of her rights and her personal sovereignty. I only ask that because people often wonder about this situation and other similar situations. What happened in the moments leading up to the shooting? What are we not seeing on the cameras, and what are we not hearing? And, of course, the broader perspective would include the whole history of destabilization in the community,
yes.
of poverty, of lack of services, etc., that places people like Makia in mm-hmm. tenuous situations where they become vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
To what degree does all of that apply here, do you think?
Columbus is resource rich and connection poor. We have all the resources that people would need, but they don't have the communication to be able to say, hey, if you just went through a traumatizing experience, contact us. We have plenty of suicide lines, but no homicide lines. Who do we talk to when we just witnessed a homicide? Maybe it's not for us. Maybe we don't feel like taking our lives, but why isn't that just as important so that we can be able to provide support? Because the thing about it is that Columbus is on track right now for one of the highest numbers of homicides. And this includes police-involved shootings and ones that are not. So we're trying to get in our community and let them know, first off, how can we support these broken areas? I can't talk to you and tell you how much I care about you and that you're valid and that I love you and that you matter, and I can't feed you. You don't want to hear that. If you love me, you'd feed me. Let's start there, where we're having a lot of things happen in Columbus due to lack, whether it's a lack of food, lack of education, lack of housing. These are all taking its toll, and it's trickling down to the children. And it's on our children's arms because they feel like it's their fault. You know, when you look at Columbus and you see that the number one folks that are still going into the eviction room, even in a moratorium, are Black single mothers. That's number one, 71%, to actually quote what the mediator said of Columbus. 71%. That's frightening. That's providing us to go into, you know, houselessness, survival instincts, things in that nature that we need to try to address as well.
So a lot of people seeing the demonstrations, which is the most visible aspect of the movement, especially through the eyes of the media, or should I say through the filter of the media, they hear demands regarding policing, police brutality, racism in policing. But the broader picture doesn't really get articulated such that people see that within the context of multi-generational demands for equality, economic equality, for resources, for fair and equitable housing, etc. How do you integrate all of those into a single message?
So what I generally do is I try to make sure that I get in contact with organizers from other areas and make sure that we're all pushing the same message, which is that we need money in our Black communities, which is we need better education and opportunity for it. It's wonderful that Columbus, Ohio has all these resources for 16-year-olds to 24, but what happens when you're 25 and you're out on the street? You still matter, right? So just being able to make sure that we are still taking care of our folks. And I think that that's one of the biggest things that we have to preach is to make sure that we're having people do self-care, that they're taking care of their mental health, that they are taking care of their well-being, because demonstrating out in these streets is hard. Organizing for protests is hard because you're putting people at risk. You're putting bodies at risk. And we don't take that lightly. But we understand that certain people can't serve in all spaces. We have people that are able to run for offices, but we also have people that's just like, hey, I'm gonna be in the street. I might not do nothing else. And we're okay with whatever capacity somebody wants to offer it. So the bigger message is just the investment and just coming into our neighborhoods. You see gentrification happening. You see Black people getting pushed out, kicked out, and all other things when we're still in what they consider a pandemic. And if the last time I checked, Columbus is level 4.
So you're not acting alone, of course. There are resources on the movement side, resources aligning in solidarity with the push for racial justice, economic justice, justice in policing, etc. I know there are some clergy involved, there are some community organizations involved, there are white allies, not necessarily organized into specific organizations, mm-hmm. but they show up anyway.
Yes.
What's your sense of where the movement is going in terms of growth and amassing a critical mass of resources that will enable you to actually get things done?
I think that last year was our ability to make mistakes. This year is our ability to make demands. And so we are taking everything that we learned from last year and making sure that they're upgraded, because we have more laws against us. You know, certain things that used to be misdemeanors before people actually started protesting are now felonies. We have to make sure that we're educating folks about their rights. With that, it allows us to show the growth that we have. So it's not just you seeing a whole bunch of people on high and broad. It's where you see you should also know that we got a lot of people at their homes supporting us, whether it's with funding, whether it's with prayer, good vibes, great intention, and just to be able to speak up. It's not just enough for you to tell me that you're not racist. It's important for you to show me that you don't participate in anything that allows racists to feel ever great again.
What about milestones moving forward? We have the Chauvin verdict. We're waiting on the Chauvin sentencing. We have the latest shooting. We still have outstanding the cases of Casey Goodson and Andre Hill. In the case of Casey Goodson, that officer hasn't even been charged. In case of Andre Hill, that officer has been charged. It looks like that's moving forward, although slowly. What are you expecting in terms of near-term milestones, whether those come about through the result of your organizing or whether they're external circumstances that you're just waiting to see the outcomes of?
Right now, first off, I want to make sure I say arrest Jason Meade.
That's the officer who shot Casey Goodson.
Yes. Arrest Jason Meade. It makes me feel unsafe when I know that as a citizen, if I was to shoot and kill somebody 5 times in their back, that I am not protected by any law, and I would have immediately been arrested. It's confined. I don't understand qualified immunity. I don't get it. So when I see things like that, we're moving so slow. It's like, we're like, okay, we're trying to get all these petitions signed just for us to say that it's not right for police officers to be immune from having a badge to kill. Right? Because that's what it is. It's a badge to be able to exercise your power. A lot of people don't understand that barbers have more training than officers. A lot of people don't get the concept that they train them mostly on how to use their gun, but not how to de-escalate. They are not trained professionals. And when we're in the street and we're like, oh, we see a naked lady walking down the street, let me call the police. That's not the answer, right? And it's very hard when you're having a revolution like this to get funded by the city. The city is not ready to fund the revolution, which is actually going to empower the community to be able to take more of a stance, meaning that they're going to be more involved in voting. They will, if we got our lower funded communities to vote like or high affluent communities, they would have just as much influence. People will start listening. Oh, hold on, they're voting. What's your issue? And so once you start to empower people like that, then you'll get the change that we truly need. The change is going to be as cleaning up our streets. And when I say cleaning up the street, I'm not talking about the $500,000 that they made as an emergency fund through city council 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'm talking about us cleaning up our people, making sure they have access to showers, making sure that they have access to being able to go to use the bathroom, because you have access to use your bathroom, correct? If we were out here, we don't. And COVID has taken its extra toll on people who are houseless, people that are people of color, and we're most affected. But just so I can push it all in together, this is what's going to move our community. Us waiting on them to get back with us, we'll be waiting forever. They love to tell black people, just wait on it. All of our songs, Negro hymns, are about waiting. And we tired of waiting. You're not dealing with your ancestors no more. You're not dealing with my great-grandmother who would have been submissive and was a sharecropper still saying Master Hines when slavery had been ended. You messing with her granddaughter who I'm not taking it. I'm not waiting. I'm demanding. Because we've been asking for years. Hey, can you please make sure that you send money so that we can feed these black children? Hey, can you please send money so that we can clothe folks? Hey, can you please send money so that we can support families? The money that y'all using for child welfare, the money that you're using for policing, that could go right in this community. And we could be having housing for houseless folks. We could be getting mental health help for folks that have mental health crisis. We could be able to get our sex workers in safe environments so that they can have other options other than sex work. We can be able to come with compassion and grace when we are dealing with folks who are battling with substance abuse. And that also means providing a safe place for you to be able to use your drugs and to be able to also offer you help, because that's what compassion looks like. You really want to clean up your streets? That's what we should do. You really want change? That's what we can do. And it all starts with the community.
So there are a number of bills now before the federal legislature and in a number of states to deal with policing reform specifically, one of which indeed seeks to end qualified immunity, and that's coming from the Biden administration directly. Are you hopeful about any of those bills? Do you think that they're steps in the right direction, or do they not go far enough, or might they set some kind of poison pill situations whereby some reforms will get granted, but they end up kind of backfiring in their inadequacy?
It just cracks me up because when I look into it, the people that are helping write this bill are officers, right? So I'm like, how do you end qualified immunity for people who don't want to end qualified immunity? And so I do support it in the essence of that this means that they will be charged as a civilian. But what is going to stop them from just calling everything justified? This person was, Miles Jackson was dealing with substance abuse. So it was justified for us to kill him, because if we didn't kill him, then he would have killed us, right? Or Micaiah was getting ready to kill another person. If we didn't kill her, she wanted to kill somebody else. There's so many maybes, right? It just it's wild when you think about it, because you know that, like, if they're able to end qualified immunity, but then funnel it into justifying everything, we haven't done anything to change. I think that police officers should be able to be treated like civilians. And if they don't live in the neighborhood, they shouldn't police. Because if you live in that neighborhood, oh, you going to act different when you met Ray Ray. And you know Ray Ray's mom. And you know how she's trying to take care of him. Then it's more of a village feel versus, you just drove 2 hours from Marion to deal with people that you have never, you haven't seen more than 3 black people at your high school. I don't want you in my neighborhood. You're aggressive, you're scared, and that should be addressed with the police. Their implicit biases that they have that black people are bad because of narratives that has happened on TV or anything that they've seen, because you're looking at a product of it. You're not looking at that 2 + 2 = 4. You're looking at the 4. And you're just wondering, well, how did we get to this 4? And then you're trying to make your own numbers to make it equal 4, right? To justify that this is the number 4. But that's not the case. We need to be looking at other things. We're so busy looking at, like, police killing that we're not looking at, okay, so what did Micaiah need? How can we support so that we can make sure that we don't have another Micaiah Bryant? What does these families need for us to support all of these mothers who are in a club that they can never be revoked out of, and they'll constantly be in it? How can we support them? I'm tired of just giving somebody money when we ain't giving them change. Yeah, we'll give you $12 million to be quiet, right? But we ain't changing none of our policies. Spend your $12 million wisely. Because you might have to have another GoFundMe for a cousin that's going to be treated the same way that your son was. We need change. That's what we want. And change isn't going to come from us sitting down with these officers when these officers have contracts that they have to abide by. You look at the FOP, and you know, since we're talking about this, the Supreme Court has ruled that it's okay for an officer to have, and I make sure that I say the word correctly, untruthfulness. They are allowed to be untruthful. At any other job, do you know where you can be untruthful at and still have that job tomorrow? And then have protection about the untruthfulness.
Well, apparently the Ohio legislature.
Yeah. So I'm over here looking like, how can you do this? And it's in their contract. This isn't a Columbus Police Department contract. This is Big Daddy FOP. So when you're dealing with FOP, you're not about to mess with their money. They're on a $368 million budget in Columbus, Ohio. $368 million. What I'll ask you is to go and find our housing budget for Columbus, right? Non-existent, because it goes to gatekeepers like Community Shelter Board, who want you to come and work with them so that they can know your plan and still be doing remediations. Right now, we're looking at about 50 camps that are getting evicted quietly. While you're over here cleaning up the streets with the litter, we got people that have nowhere to go. They're already outside. So you want to move them from one location that they've been outside, being able to get support, be able to get harm reduction supplies, get food, have access to come and have compassion, togetherness, somebody to know that you're okay, and that you, if you weren't showing up, we would care and try to figure out what's going on and support you. No, they're like, hey, we're going to move you all the way over here where nobody can see you, because right now we need to sell this property. And in Columbus, it's property over people every trip.
So what would you like people to do here locally? How can people support your efforts? Are there specific projects they can sign up to? Some upcoming demonstrations you'd like to see people turn out for? Letters you'd like to see people write? How can people get involved directly?
I would like for everybody to educate themselves. The way that I would say it to support is whatever's your space, whatever's your comfortableness. I don't want to tell you to come out in these streets and you don't feel comfortable, you don't have a babysitter, you're going to do something risky so you can be in the street with me? No. If you don't have time to do that, can you make sandwiches so that we can pass them out to houseless folks? Can you donate clothes so that we can make sure that kids that are out here living with their parents in their cars can be able to get their, have access to washing their clothes, taking a shower? We need support with that, because that's where we wouldn't have to deal with all this policing if people had access to things that they shouldn't even have to lack on. You know what I mean? Like, they shouldn't have to lack on electric, clean water, you know? You know how hard it is to get clean water when you're houseless and broke? You know that all the water fountains are closed due to COVID? And then we're wondering why we're having people that's dealing with high blood pressure and going through mental health crises. And then we have these people that are in mental health crisis, such as like Jerron Thomas. And he was in his mental health crisis and called the police, and the police still killed him. They're still like messing up. But just to stay on track, they can support me in whatever capacity they feel safest. I would say to share. I would say to donate. To donate to people that you know are doing the work. These organizations are great, but we don't see a dollar of that. I know I've gotten asked multiple times, doing multiple interviews, am I a paid protester? I have never seen a dime nor a penny to protest. And I'm doing this because I'm a mother of six. I have five black boys. And I don't want to have a hashtag for none of their names. We're tired of hashtags, and we don't want to say another name.
Several protests were held following our interview. Several hundred people did gather at Goodale Park on Sunday, however, and that one was announced online. I was there and recorded the following audio.
For Casey Goodson Jr., for Andre Hill, Deontay Bell, Tyree King, Jerron Thomas, Christopher Wade, Kareem Jones, Kwame Patrick, Henry Green, Jaquarius Robinson, and this is all just in Columbus.
And there's many more names just from the past 6 years. That's only one portion of it. Today we are here to continue to lift up the life of Micaiah Bryant. We have her family here with us, and I'm going to let her aunt, Myra, introduce the family. So we can make some noise for Micaiah Bryant and her family, please.
Hold the mic closer. Hold the mic closer.
Okay. First off, I just want to thank everybody for being here. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your dedication for justice for Micaiah. I'm sure you can imagine this is a tragic event. It doesn't seem real. You never think that it's going to be your family that's going to be impacted by something so big and so wrong. It knocked at our front door, and it's so unfortunate. We love Micaiah. Micaiah was with us. This is her grandmother. These are her brothers and her sisters. I'm her aunt. Even though she was in foster care many times, she was with us. She spent the night over at my mother's house. She went to school for my mother. She was with her brothers and sisters. We are the family that know and love Micaiah. I'm sure you guys have seen in the media, she loved music. She loved to do hair. She was an awesome cook. She was had a heart of gold. Micaiah was an angel that we were blessed to have for 16 years. And this situation didn't have to happen like this. The system has failed Micaiah on so many levels. There are so many different outcomes where Micaiah would still be alive. So thank you for your support. Thank you for being here. Justice for Micaiah Bryant. And Black Lives definitely matter. Make some noise for Micaiah Bryant. So we all know that the system itself is what failed Micaiah Bryant, and it failed so many Black youth and so many Black adults, just the Black community in general, but the system, from the foster care system to the judicial system, they failed Micaiah Bryant because she should be alive. She was a 16-year-old child trying to protect herself. And it's too often that we call the police for help and they make us the criminal. They criminalize and dehumanize us in our death. So, again, thank y'all so much for coming out today. And, like, this is heavy, and this feels more personal than anything else because I am a Black woman. I once was a Black girl. And Micaiah deserved to live to adulthood, have a full life. She had a 5-year plan that she's not able to execute because she was executed by the police, and that's what that was. That's what you saw. So for anyone that wants to continue to defend the police's actions, we had many options. He had so many options that he chose the lethal option. He didn't save another person's life. He ended one person's life, and that's all he did. And that's all Nicholas Verda needs to be noted for. Enough is enough. Columbus, Ohio is not safe for Black people, and we don't say that in jest. We say that because that's the reality in our communities as they fly over our communities with their choppers in the middle of the night, as they run through our neighborhoods and arrest us without cause and harass us. As even when we stand up for Black lives, they harass us and target us. And it's not okay. The mayor turns his head to it. City council don't say anything about it. And enough is enough, because Columbus, Ohio cannot continue to be overlooked when we're literally fighting for our lives out here. This is a genocide against the Black community in Columbus, Ohio. Right. And it's not okay. Micaiah, just like Tyree, should be alive today. Tyree didn't get to graduate. He was a 13-year-old child. And don't let video evidence, or what they want to call evidence, I don't need a video to know that she was a child and she deserved to live. Okay. I don't need a video to know that the police has continued to commit crimes against the Black community. I don't need a video to know that our lives matter. That video evidence that they so quickly pushed out is a part of their agenda to say, hey, we're the good guys protecting and serving. No, that wasn't an action of protecting and serving anyone. That was an action of an execution of a child.
It was a murder.
That was a murder.
That's what it
and he needs to be held accountable. Right. Nicholas Reardon needs to be held accountable. He hasn't even been on the force for 2 years, yet he got his first body, which is a child. Micaiah Bryant should be here. Her family shouldn't have to suffer. They shouldn't have to join a club that no one wants to be a part of. These unexpected losses in our community does damage from the top to the bottom. It affects us all. And this is a national crisis, just like it's a local crisis. It's not an isolated incident. And this is why we ask for the defunding of the police. This is why we're asking for the abolishment of the police. This is why we are demanding the abolishment of a system that refuses to see us as even human.
That's right.
Because if you can blame George Floyd for having an addiction after you've seen a video of 9 minutes and 29 seconds of him being murdered, absolutely murdered, then yes, we have an issue. And we've been had an issue. And there's no such thing as reforming a system that is working exactly how it is supposed to be made to work. For the upper class, for the white upper class,
1%, 1%,
for the white upper class.
1%.
And it doesn't include any of us out here.
No.
Doesn't include black and brown people.
No.
It doesn't include the poor who are trying to survive. And it didn't include Micaiah Bryant. And that's not okay. So the mayor wants to come out and call her a young woman. She was a child.
Exactly.
And it's enough that they adultify black children and we're not even allowed to have childhoods and be kids and make mistakes. Micaiah Bryant should be alive.
That's right.
And that's what we need to keep saying. She should be alive, but she's not. So we have to. It's our duty as a community and as organizers to fight for justice for Micaiah and advocate for her. It is our duty as a community and as organizers to support this family. And a lot of people have been asking how to support them monetarily. They are actively working on that. And when I have that information, I will definitely share it, because this family deserves every dollar to support her, to support her funeral prices, expenses, to support the children and her siblings. She should be with her siblings right now. And this just really breaks my heart, because Tyree King was also a child and he was never given the benefit of the doubt, and black children are never given the benefit of the doubt, and it's not okay. Say her name. 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 So next we'll have Zach. He is a local social worker and he also works with KIPP.
The whole damn system is guilty as hell. My name is Zach and I'm a social worker. And when I say the whole damn system, I mean the whole damn system. Social work and the child welfare system are guilty as hell. Right now, there are over 400,000 children in the foster care system, and that system is letting them down. Micaiah Bryant was in foster care. Micaiah was killed by a system that was aware of the problems but failed to do anything. She died defending herself in a fight with former foster children, now adults, who lived in the same home. The argument was about chores and escalated very quickly, and her foster mom was not home to intervene. Her foster home was not a safe place for youth, and Micaiah had even shared many concerns with her family. Since November, there had been seven calls to 911. Clearly, the home was in crisis. The youth in that home were not having their needs met and needed help. I want to be clear that I'm not blaming any single individual other than Officer Nicholas Reardon, who murdered Micaiah. I have so much empathy for people who volunteer their homes and lives to take in children, many of whom have complex needs and traumatic histories. I have so much respect for the Children's Services caseworkers who are overworked, overburdened, and underpaid. Instead, the system as a whole is to blame. I don't know the details of what life was like in that foster home, but seven calls since November is enough for me to know that either the foster mom needed more support or the children needed a new foster home. Or maybe Micaiah's family needed more support to be able to, yes, for her to be able to stay at home with her family where she belonged. Yes. Yes. There are many children who are in foster care because their families simply did not have enough resources to take care of their children. And what happens? They get taken from their homes, sent to a foster home, and the state gives that foster parent money to take care of somebody else's child, when that child could be at home with their own family if the state just supported them. I think everyone here recognizes that the system of policing in this country is also guilty as hell and is responsible for Micaiah's death. But I've heard people say the officer was allowed to use force to defend another person. And to those people, I say that just because it may have been legal does not mean it was right.
That's right.
Expand your imagination of what is possible. Violence does not have to be met with violence. As a social worker, I have de-escalated so many violent situations with children and teens without anyone getting hurt. I once had a teen try to shank me, and everyone walked away from that situation safely because I recognized that behind that teen's violence was fear. Some of you may remember that in 2017, a student opened fire at Columbus Scioto High School. One of the counselors approached the shooter, encouraged him to hand over the gun, and sat and talked with him for a half an hour until he was ready to turn himself in. The counselor stood by his side the whole time. No one was injured that morning. I'll say it again. Violence does not have to be met with violence. We can abolish the police and be safer than we've ever been. The word abolition focuses on eliminating something, in this case, the police. However, the concept of abolition actually focuses on the presence of the things, like community care and support, which actually make a meaningful difference in preventing crime. When everyone has access to stable housing, adequate nutrition, health and mental health care, an excellent education, and a caring community of family, friends, and neighbors, they don't need to steal or join gangs, and they have the skills to peacefully resolve conflict and control impulses. Of course, things will still happen. People will still get angry, and problems will still need responses. So what if, instead of cops who only speak one language, violence, we had social workers, crisis workers, addiction counselors, and other professionals who could respond? What if people could call to get help for themselves or for others without fear that somebody will be killed? Miles Jackson didn't need police. He needed a substance use counselor. Andre Hill didn't need police. He needed a mechanic. Micaiah Bryant didn't need police. She needed nonviolent crisis response. City Council has talked about investing money in alternative crisis response. They sent out a survey, they've held town halls, and they've talked a lot. They have a working group, but they have yet to commit to an alternative crisis response that does not involve the police. So I call on City Council to take action now. As you keep dragging your feet, the lives of Black folks and other people of color are in danger of police brutality, violence, and murder every day. Columbus is not safe for Black people. City Council, you already have blood on your hands from each act of violence committed by the police. How much more blood are you willing to collect?
The rally in Goodale Park was relatively short after starting nearly an hour late, and folks who gathered then proceeded to march up to High Street, where it occupied an intersection for a while. I drove by to get a photo and witnessed four motorcyclists marauding the protesters by revving their unmufflered engines and peeling out deliberately, raising clouds of smoke amid their nauseous din. One of the four apparently blew a gasket as he left. He left a quantity of engine coolant on the road along with chunks of rubber from his tire. Here's hoping the repairs are very expensive. Since those events, the attorney representing Micaiah Bryant's family and also the mayor and city attorney have each separately petitioned the U.S. Department of Justice to intervene, and in one case to review and another case to investigate the Columbus Police Department. We'll cover that and its possible implications in next week's show, and we'll take a look at Republican efforts to cast doubts on the election results in Arizona and elsewhere. That'll be next week on Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you here then. Take care.